Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Andrea. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. Today's program is on treatment update on pancreatic cancer. And I know many of you have waited for this call. It's an important call for all of you on the call today. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other organizations. And I particularly want to identify the pancreatic cancer organizations on the call. So we have Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. We have Cure Pancreatic Cancer, the Losgarten Foundation, and Hirschberg Foundation for Pancreatic Cancer Research, as well as all of the other collaborating groups, and, of course, all of your interest in this program today and all of our groups letting you know about the program. So we have over 626 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So really this is a very large call, and it's a global call as well. Today's program was supported by an unrestricted educational grant from Insight and Celgene Corporation, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program and also for their corporate collaboration and partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our call today, really just the best, I have to say, and I'm going to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Irene O'Reilly, and Dr. O'Reilly is Associate Director, Clinical Research, David M. Rubenstein Center for Pancreatic Cancer, attending physician, member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. O'Reilly is going to present an overview of pancreatic cancer, current standard of care, and new treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. O'Reilly.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. Good afternoon, everybody. Greetings from New York. A pleasure to be here. So for the next 10 or 15 minutes, just going to review some of the background regarding pancreas cancer, a little bit about the presentation, staging, and how we think about it from the treatment approaches and touch on some of the new treatments. So just some of the facts related to pancreas cancer. This cancer is on the rise, and it's anticipated that there will be approximately 50,000 people in North America diagnosed each year. It's a cancer that gets more common as we get older. Average age is just over 70, and about 40% of people will be diagnosed over the age of 75. It's a bit of a sneaky business in that this cancer is insidious with regard to no early warning symptoms. And for many people that are diagnosed, the cancer has either involved key blood vessels or indeed has spread, with main sites of metastasis being the liver, lungs, abdominal cavity, and lymph nodes. So one of the common questions that we're often asked is, you know, why is this cancer increasing, and what are the underlying factors? And it's not entirely known, but as the population ages, that may be part of this. I think some part relates to the adoption of Western lifestyles in terms of diet, in terms of obesity, in terms of lack of exercise, and cigarette smoking, all of these being risk factors for this disease. But in truth, for many, we really don't understand why a given individual develops this disease. Other factors that are always in our mind when we meet a new person diagnosed with this cancer is whether there might be any familial or genetic predisposition to this disease. And that can account for about 7 to 10% of people with pancreas cancer, and sometimes we'll have a fairly strong clue from the family background as to what that genetic underpinning might be. For example, the BRCA genes are associated with pancreas cancer after breast and ovary cancer, not as well known in terms of their association with pancreas cancer, but that's actually important in terms of the implications for the individual with the disease, for their family, and potentially for treatment. Now, we believe that this can help refine treatment choices. Other genes less commonly changed include something called PALB2, which relates to the BRCA genes. And what's gotten a fair bit of publicity in the context of the emergence of immune therapies as an approach to treating cancer is the recognition that a small subset of patients with pancreas cancer will have changes in genes called DNA mismatch repair genes. That's a 1 to 2% of people, but there may be a significant potential for immune therapy in that particular patient population. So this disease is an adenocarcinoma, meaning it's a glandular cancer, and there are a number of characteristics of pancreas cancer when we look at it down the microscope. First is that it's sort of encompassed in a supporting matrix called a stroma that's often characterized by a lack of blood vessels, meaning that the oxygenation of the supporting cells for this cancer are not so high. There may be actually relatively few cancer cells. To a degree, a lack of immune cells, or perhaps not the best immune cells, and a lot of inflammation in the makeup of this disease. And some of these factors may be part of the reasons that pancreas cancer can be challenging in terms of treatment approaches. So thinking about symptoms that people present with, a common one is noting dark urine, itching and eyes going yellow and jaundice. That's very typical for patients with tumors that arise in the head or the center portion of the pancreas, which is the most common area. Sometimes abdominal discomfort or back pain can be associated with this disease. Often people will feel tired. Sometimes people will notice changes in their bowel habits. Their bowel movements get oily or greasy or light, or they're having discomforts before, during, or after eating. And I know this will be touched on later with regard to nutrition and how to help minimize those symptoms. Pancreas cancer is also associated with a number of other issues with regard to presentation. Sometimes the bile duct can be blocked and can require a stent or like a chicken mesh wire pipe put into the bile duct to open it and relieve the jaundice. Sometimes the upper part of the small bowel called the duodenum can be blocked. We need to put a stent in there. Blood clots in the lungs, in the legs can be a common presentation also of this disease. So when we want to make the diagnosis, imaging is critical, and in particular optimal imaging, and that's often an initial step is an ultrasound, but from the cancer diagnosis and treatment perspective, a high-quality CT, which is administered with intravenous contrast and often water as an oral contrast agent, and that gives high definition of the pancreas tumor and its relationship to blood vessels, which is important in terms of surgical decision making, and also allows us to get a sense of whether the cancer spread beyond the pancreas, and that has implications in terms of how treatment is planned for that particular patient. Diagnosis is often made by use of an endoscopic ultrasound, passing a fine needle into the pancreas, sampling those cells. That's called cytology, and that's a common way. Or if there is, for example, a lesion in the liver or the lungs, we'll often go directly to that and do a core needle biopsy to allow sufficient tissue for documentation of the diagnosis. And these days, more and more, we're studying the genetic makeup of the tumor on a research basis and indeed on a treatment basis. So that is, we'll often take more tissue than we used to in the past. So thinking about how treatment is approached in this disease, very importantly, we want to accurately understand what the stage of the cancer is, whether the cancer is localized, and in that category we think of whether it's directly operable or whether it's inoperable but localized, and in this category in between called borderline resectable disease, where there's a potential for not going directly to the operating room now but after treatment to follow on with surgery, or whether it's clearly metastatic at the beginning when, for the most part, surgical and radiation-based approaches aren't the mainstay of treatment. And there, the focus is on what we call systemic treatments, which can include chemotherapy, but can also include clinical trials, of which there's a variety underway. A very important point, and I think my colleagues on the call will echo this, is that we try not to make decisions in isolation with this disease. It really is a disease where a multidisciplinary approach and expertise from surgical oncologists, from medical oncologists, gastroenterologists, radiation oncologists, radiologists, and all of the teams that look after people with this disease have input. And this is particularly true when the cancer is localized and we're trying to decide, should this person go to the operating room? Is this person better served by upfront chemotherapy and or radiation, et cetera? And most centers that look after this disease will function as a group and capitalize on that multidisciplinary expertise to try and come to the best consensus approach for a given patient to optimize the outcome. So thinking about surgery, a 15% to 20% of people who are diagnosed with this cancer will be candidates at the time of their diagnosis for surgery. And here the cancer is localized. There's no major blood vessel involvement. And for people with tumors in the head of the pancreas, we said the most common area, the operation that's typically undertaken is a Whipple surgery, which is taking out part of the head of the pancreas, part of the bile duct, part of the duodenum, the gallbladder, sometimes a little part of the stomach, and essentially replumbing so that there's continuity for all of the tracts internally. And then we'll typically recommend postoperative or adjuvant therapy. That's treatment designed to try and eliminate any microscopic cells and to try and maximize the chances of the cancer not coming back. At the moment, in 2016, a drug called gemcitabine is a mainstay of postoperative treatment, but there are a series of trials underway, some of which will have data on this spring, which are looking at combinations of medications in this postoperative setting to see if two drugs is better than one. And we know in other settings in pancreas cancer that indeed it often is so. So I think we're potentially going to see some changes this year in terms of how we guide patients in the post-operative setting. And most of the direction there is indirectly coming from what's happening in the setting of metastatic pancreas cancer where the disease has spread. So moving to that setting for a few minutes, and this is the most common scenario that we encounter with this cancer. About half of patients who are diagnosed at presentation will have spread to the abdominal cavity primarily. And here, the mainstay of treatment is non-surgical based, non-radiation based, but chemotherapy based. And there are several combination chemotherapeutic approaches that are under consideration for a person with a new diagnosis of pancreas cancer. And they include gemcitabine combined with a drug called nab-paclitaxel, or a combination of medications called FOLFIRINOX. And that includes a drug called 5-FU, a medication called oxaliplatin, medication called irinotecan, and a modulator of that of 5-FU called leucovorin, that's a vitamin. So they're commonly used, and a lot of times we'll spend part of our discussion kind of weighing out which is a preferred approach for a given patient in terms of where they are and what the goals and prospects for that treatment are, sort of aligned with what the side effects of the treatment are. And for example, one of these combinations causes more hair loss, so that understandably can be a significant point of discussion. The other one requires a port placement for FOLFIRINOX, and that can be a little bit more inconvenient for people in that they have treatment infusing for a couple of days every couple of weeks at home, and doesn't fit for everybody. So the nice news in late 2015 is that we had an additional tool that's now at our disposal for the treatment of pancreas cancer, and this is in the setting beyond initial treatment, and that's a drug called liposomal irinotecan, or MM398, that has been combined with 5-FU and has demonstrated activity and indeed enhancing outcome and improving survival for people with this disease, as have these other regimens too in their different settings in pancreas cancer. So that's clearly going to be built on, and there's a number of trials underway and planned to understand how that combination can be more fully integrated into treatment. And I should mention that there are some similarities between this drug and a drug that's a component of FOLFIRINOX called irinotecan, and we don't have evidence that one is better than the other. They've just been studied in different settings in pancreas cancer, and both clearly have relevant and meaningful activity for people. So all of what we talked about so far falls within the remit of standard treatments, and just going to spend a couple of moments highlighting some of the research areas, and Dr. Varadachari, who follow, will touch on this in a little bit more detail. So pancreas cancer gives us a luxury of opportunities in terms of new treatment directions, and one of them is trying to break down this stroma or this supporting environment. And there are a number of drugs that are in later stage development. A drug called PEG-PH20 is being evaluated in the setting of newly diagnosed pancreas cancer, combined on a backbone of gemcitabine and paclitaxel, and that's kind of an exciting area of research. It's not for everybody, and this drug does have some side effects that may make it not the right fit for a given person. We do know that some people with a genetic underpinning to their disease, either in what we call the germline, the family genetics, or indeed in their tumor, may benefit experimentally from platinum drugs, and also experimentally from PARP inhibitors, which are a class of drugs that are FDA approved in ovary cancer where there's a BRCA mutation. So there's a lot of work around that area in pancreas cancer, and understanding if there are other genes that can be changed where we can also begin to target. And then a very common question that we all get asked is where immune therapy fits in this disease, based on the signals that we know in cancer in general, in melanoma, in kidney cancer, in lung cancer. Pancreas cancer is certainly more challenging in this context. However, there are clearly hints of how we can begin to both manipulate the environment of pancreas cancer and modulate the immune system and leverage some of the tools that we have to allow this to be more optimized in terms of treating the cancer and pancreas cancer. And we mentioned there's a small subset of people that have what we call MSI, where they may particularly benefit from immune therapy strategies. So a lot of trials and approaches underway here, combining various immune strategies. So thank you. I'm going to stop there and pass it back to Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Dr. O'Reilly. That was really outstanding and just a wonderful overview and really presenting a lot of information. I know there'll be questions for you. They're already coming in, actually, so thank you so much, and we'll be back to you during the Q&A session, I know. And our next speaker is Dr. Gauri Bhattachary, and Dr. Bhattachary is Professor, Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology, Division of Cancer Medicine, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Bhattachary is going to address the role of clinical trials, their contribution to treatment options, symptoms, side effect, and pain management, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bhattachary.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for the opportunity to discuss clinical trials and managing symptoms. So what I would like to start with is just provide an overview first of the role of clinical trials and some common terminology that we use when discussing trials and reviewing these on the internet. So innovative research is absolutely crucial to make meaningful progress for this very challenging disease, and research itself does contribute to treatment options for our patients. So there is a vast amount of information on the internet, and it can be very helpful if one can navigate the system successfully, but I do hear from a lot of our patients that there is too much information, and sometimes they feel quite lost and overwhelmed. So when you look at a trial, you know, more often than not, it starts off with the three phases. The trial may be phase 1, 2, and 3. And the question is, what does this mean and what does it mean for pancreatic cancer? So phase one trials, and this is important because more and more pancreatic cancer patients have the option of getting into a phase one or phase two trial now. The phase one trial is the earliest trial in the life of a new drug or treatment. And these trials are considered hypothesis generating. And the idea here is to learn quickly if a new treatment is of value to evaluate it vigorously going forward. A typical phase one trial is a small trial with less than 30 patients, though that trend is changing now. And in the last few years, the lines between phase one and two trials are getting a little blurry. But in a typical trial, patients with any type of advanced cancer can be enrolled, and the idea here is to build on what we have learned from the laboratory, the preclinical cell and animal studies. And most patients with advanced cancer getting onto these trials have taken standard treatments. So as mentioned by Dr. O'Reilly, patients may have taken a combination of treatments before going on. That could be FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, or the phase one trial may incorporate these drugs as well as a backbone. So it could be FOLFIRINOX plus drug X or gem-nab-paclitaxel plus drug Y. And the idea with these trials is to look for a safe dose range for this new drug and the side effects, and does it add on to more side effects to the cytotoxics that the patients are taking as standard of care. And patients may not benefit from the treatment. The idea here is to first understand if there is a future for the new treatment to build on the existing treatments. Most of the phase one trials today do tend to have targeted drugs that block multiple cancer pathways, and they can be with chemo or alone or a combination of targeted therapies. Phase two trials are the efficacy-seeking trial, and it's done to find out if a new treatment for pancreatic cancer works for the disease and to learn more about the side effects and how to manage them. So phase two trials are usually larger than phase one trials and can be up to 100 patients or more. And nowadays, the trials are randomized, and this means that patients taking part in the trial can be randomized into two groups. One group gets the new treatment, and the other is the standard treatment. This could be with or without placebo. This is a new trend from the science point of view, and it can help us understand if the new drug has meaningful use to proceed to phase three. The phase three trials compare new treatments with the best currently available treatment, which is the standard treatment Dr. O'Reilly referred to. Phase three trials are usually large with several hundred patients, and these are randomized trials. And again, one group of patients get the new treatment and the other the standard treatment. Now, all the treatments that Dr. O'Reilly talked about have gone through phase three to get to be FDA approved. And one of the recent phase three trials that received approval was the MM398, which is the nanoliposomal irinotecan, which is very similar to the irinotecan that has been used in FOLFIRINOX. Another trend that we have seen over years is looking at trials that are predictive biomarker-enriched designs. Now, what does this mean? Predictive biomarkers help us assess or predict the most likely response to a particular treatment type. Now, there is a lot of interest in understanding which drug is a good fit in which patient, and instead of expecting one treatment-fit-all strategy, use drugs that would be helpful to a patient. One example of this, again, Dr. O'Reilly alluded to, is the PEG-PH20, which is a recombinant human hyaluronidase enzyme. This is an enzyme that temporarily degrades an acid, a hyaluronin, that accumulates in the stroma of pancreatic cancer. So in the phase three trial of this drug, the cancer has to have a high level of this particular molecule to proceed with enrollment. So this is a trial that is now enriched to have that particular change in the tissue to get onto the study. So that's your predictive biomarker enriched study. As Dr. Riley mentioned, there is a lot of interest in immunotherapy-based trials in pancreatic cancer. They are typically in phase or one or phase two design right now, and the trials are also interrogating tissue for genomic studies. So tissue access has become important, and sometimes there's a request to repeat a biopsy, so it's really important that pancreatic cancer tissue is used wisely, and we understand exactly what is being studied. Bottom line, there are many trials right now that are enrolling patients to study novel therapies. Some websites to consider include www.cancer.gov. Another is clinicaltrials.gov or pancan.org. And most importantly, it's really important to talk to your doctor about options. So what are the few things that you can ask your doctor besides just, you know, having some information on what trials there are? One is to ask what phase of trial it is. You know, what are the side effects that are different from the current non-trial option being offered? How often a test going to be done? Is there a need for a PICC line or a portacath placement? And will insurance company pay for the expenses involved, though most groups will check that independently? Are there any special instructions for family members? So, It is important to know that clinical trials do increase options for our patients beyond drugs that we have available today, and this conversation should start early with your doctor to know what's the best fit trial for you and your care. So switching gear and talking a bit about management of pain, fatigue, and other symptoms, advanced pancreatic cancer can cause pain in many patients, but it is very important to note that cancer pain can be managed very effectively in most patients. The severity and occurrence of cancer pain depends on the position of the tumor, the stage of the cancer, the location of metastases. As we are all aware, pain affects each person differently, and also depression, poor sleep, fatigue, anxiety can lower a patient's pain threshold. The goal of pain management is twofold. First, to make sure a patient is pain-free, and second, as functional as possible to enhance quality of life. The treatment approaches are classified as pharmacological, which is medications, or non-pharmacological. So pharmacological pain control involves the use of painkillers, and mostly after starting with non-narcotic medications, patients may need narcotic pain medications like morphine, oxycodone, methadone as part of their pain therapy. The typical side effects include nausea, constipation, sedation, sometimes itching, and doctors do need to ask the patients about this, and we have to educate our patients regarding these side effects and make sure that it's not causing more concerns, and it is important to manage with an aggressive bowel regimen if necessary. Some patients may be candidates for a procedure called the celiac nerve block, and typically the concern there is that there's back pain, the narcotic pain medications are not working or are intolerant, and it's an outpatient procedure done by the pain team, and this can reduce the need for narcotics in some patients. Other approaches for pain control may include radiation in selected patients, especially if the pain is coming from the bone metastases or a primary tumor. Rarely in selected patients, neurosurgical techniques, including an epidural pump, may be helpful, but in my practice, we rarely use or feel the need for epidural pumps. Again, let's talk a bit more about other troubling symptoms. Fatigue is one, jaundice is the other. In fatigue, it is an important symptom in our patients, and cancer fatigue is important to address because it can have a very negative influence on a patient's quality of life. And it's important not to accept it as a new normal, but to discuss it with your healthcare team if there are any correctable options available. Some of the things we look for is there pain that's not treated optimally? Could it be the opioid use that's actually making it worse? What about anemia, the dose of chemotherapy, lack of sleep, dehydration, depression, lack of exercise? And the healthcare team can work with you to create a plan looking at the labs, the chemo, as well as some of the other opportunities to minimize fatigue. Jaundice is a symptom that Dr. O'Reilly touched on. Jaundice can develop either because of blockage of the bile duct or a cancer burden in the liver. It can cause yellowing of skin, eyes, urine, loss of appetite, weight loss, nausea, itching. And in patients with advanced cancer, if it's coming from a blocked bile duct, the treatment of choice is a stent that's inserted into the bile duct to allow drainage of bile into the intestines. If there's buildup of fluid in the abdomen called ascites, this can be removed by administering a needle or a catheter into the abdomen. Another symptom that is of concern to all is weight loss, and we do check our patients' weight each visit. There are several reasons, including chemotherapy-induced nausea or loss of appetite, no taste, pancreatic insufficiency, depression, so many that could affect patients' weight. And Maria will talk more about managing weight loss in pancreatic cancer after Whipple surgery, but I do want to mention that as oncologists, after reviewing chemotherapy side effects, making some changes, reviewing the cancer status, if weight loss and especially poor appetite is a concern, we do consider appetite-building medications for our patients. And lastly, I want to just touch on quality of life. It is very important in our pancreatic cancer patients, and understandably, there are many concerns. So it is very crucial that the doctor and patient evaluate this on a regular, ongoing basis. There's a lot that can be done for depression, pain, fatigue, weight loss, and chemotherapy-related side effects. And a regular conversation is very important so that the doctor and the patient can make the best decisions at each visit. So I'm going to stop here, and I thank you all for your attention.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bharatichari. That was outstanding and very comprehensive, and I know that there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, and just wonderful. Thank you so much for that, all that information. Thank you. And expertise, actually. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Maria Petzl. Ms. Petzl is a dietitian. She's senior clinical dietitian, pancreas surgery program, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Petzl is going to address managing weight loss and eating hints. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Petzl.
Hi, thank you very much, and thanks to all who have joined the call today. Jumping right in, our nutrition goals are to prevent or reverse poor nutrition, to maintain dose and schedule of cancer treatments, to manage symptoms, to maintain or improve weight and strength, and to help maximize quality of life. Common concerns for patients with pancreatic cancer are weight loss, pain, diarrhea, pancreatic enzymes, and then in general, just what to eat. So causes of weight loss can include inadequate intake due to either the side effects of treatment, such as poor appetite, taste changes, feeling full very quickly after eating, or symptoms such as nausea or vomiting. But the causes of weight loss can also be tumor-induced, so this can be related to hypermetabolism or something called cancer cachexia. And also malabsorption can be a cause of weight loss. So this is related to the pancreas not being able to make enough enzymes to help digest the food. And oftentimes we see the result of diarrhea. So some tips in general to help manage these side effects are to eat small, frequent meals, so 6 to 8 times a day, planning meals and snacks the day before to eliminate conversation or concern or time spent trying to decide what to eat, making sure to drink plenty of fluids. Most patients need between 6 and 8 cups of fluid per day, and many of these fluids can be calorie and protein-containing fluids so that it can really help with not just getting fluids in, but getting additional nutrition. In patients that have difficulty tolerating foods, limiting the portion of fat that's used or limiting portions of high-fat foods in an effort to help minimize side effects of those high-fat foods. And then also being sure to choose nutrient-dense foods, foods with lots of calories and protein, vitamins, and minerals, avoiding high-sugar foods that simply give calories but no other nutrients. And then being active. This can help with digestion, this can help with appetite, and it can help fight fatigue. Diarrhea can be a common side effect that many patients are dealing with, and so in the setting of diarrhea, it's helpful to limit or avoid lactose-containing foods. If lactose-containing foods such as yogurt, cottage cheese, milk are staples of a patient's diet, then they may supplement with lactase, which is the enzyme that helps break down lactose, and continue to include those lactose-containing foods in their diet. If somebody is actively having diarrhea, then limiting insoluble fiber foods. So these are going to be foods like whole grains, raw fruits with thick peels, raw vegetables. So in the setting of diarrhea, limiting these foods until that diarrhea has resolved. Also foods that are high in sugar and foods that are sweetened with sugar alcohols can also contribute to diarrhea. To help thicken the stool and decrease diarrhea symptoms, using more foods with that are high in soluble fiber. So these are foods like apple without the peel, banana, oats, or foods made from whole oat flour, also citrus fruits without a lot of membrane. And then, of course, it's important to replace electrolytes that are lost when somebody is having loose or frequent stools. So including high potassium foods, high sodium foods, and also using fluids such as electrolyte drinks, sports drinks, or oral rehydration solutions as a way to help replace those electrolytes. Diarrhea can also be a symptom of pancreatic insufficiency or enzyme insufficiency. Common symptoms are feelings of indigestion, cramping after meals, large amounts of gas, very foul-smelling gas or stools, stools that float or are greasy or fatty, also frequent stools, loose stools, and in the setting of none of these, even unexplained weight loss. It's important to remember that patients that require pain medication may have a masking of some of these symptoms. So pain medication can slow the bowel down. So oftentimes we have patients with normal bowel movements, but they may have other symptoms such as indigestion, excessive gas, or cramping after meals that could be related to inadequate enzyme insufficiency. So how do we treat this? We prescribe pancreatic enzymes, so it's just simply a replacement of what the body normally makes. So if you have these symptoms or you suspect that you have pancreatic enzyme insufficiency, please talk with your healthcare team as you may benefit from a prescription of pancreatic enzymes. Now, every person needs different amounts of pancreatic enzymes, and the amount that somebody needs depends on the treatment that they're receiving, depends on their disease, and the amount of fat in the diet. So it's important to work with your healthcare team to find the right dose and strength to help manage your symptoms. Moving along, patients are always interested to know what should they eat. I think it's really important that each day and each meal that you go into, that you try to make the best choice possible at that time. And you should never have guilt over any choice that you make. Ideally, we want to support the body in the best, healthiest way possible. So definitely choosing protein with each meal and each snack. So including lean cuts of poultry and fish, occasionally lean cuts of meat, beef or pork. Also including beans, peas, lentils, low-fat or fat-free dairy products, eggs, meat and milk alternatives such as soy products or products that are fortified with vegetable protein, also tofu, and then supplementing with protein powders as needed. Also, nuts and seeds can be good sources of protein. Rounding out our meals with fruits, vegetables, and complex carbohydrates. So trying to use carbohydrate foods that are not high in refined sugars. Filling in calories with fats as tolerated, ideally getting more of those fats from healthy sources such as olive oil, canola oil, peanut oil, utilizing avocado, olives, and nuts and seeds for additional calories. Sometimes patients benefit from supplementing with liquid nutritional drinks or homemade smoothies. So these could be commercially available products or a homemade smoothie made with a good protein source and good sources of calories. For additional information on nutritional resources, there are some great resources from Cancer Care, including a recent teleconference that's available in the archives from February of this year, and from the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, a diet and nutrition booklet, and additional archived webinars. I also encourage all of you to ask to speak with a registered dietitian at your cancer center. If there's not a dietitian available, you can contact Cancer Care or the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network for guidance into how to find a dietitian who specializes in oncology nutrition. And I'm going to turn this back over to Carolyn. I appreciate this time.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Petzl. That was really, really outstanding and covered a lot of really important topics. And I know there'll be another question for you also. They're coming in online. So thank you very much. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra, and Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker, and she is pancreatic cancer program coordinator for cancer care. And Ms. Ezra is going to address Cancer Kids' free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn, and I'm glad that I'm able to address everyone today. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with pancreatic cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustments, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the side effects. At this time, Cancer Care offers a pancreatic cancer patient telephone support group. There is also a specific online caregiver group for people who are taking care of somebody with pancreatic cancer. Cancer Care also provides some financial assistance for transportation, and as I said before, we do have the copay assistance. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 or go to our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your diagnosis and the treatment that you need. We actually have a new, newly formatted website, so I encourage everyone to take a look at that. As we have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Please give us a call. We have a lot of things that will be able to help you. And especially, please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care's services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Liz. That was really wonderful. And thank you for just explaining all the services that people can access. And I know some of you on the call may be using the services, but some of you may not be as familiar with them. We're simply a phone call away, so that's really important. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. And I'm going to ask Andrea to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to all the questions, I will, at the very end of the program, give you all the information you need to get your questions answered if we didn't answer them. We're going to try to, though, nevertheless, take as many as possible right now. So I'm going to ask Andrea to explain how to queue up the questions, and we'll let the questions begin. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Again, Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star, then one.
We have a question from one of our online participants, and actually, I have been prescribed Relistor for opioid-induced constipation, diagnosed with pancreatic cancer 1 month ago, and they're being asked for help with other non-opioid options for pain relief. I have tried every one, and none have helped my pain that I'm now dealing with. Dr. Bhattachary, that's an excellent question, and we're going to actually answer this question in a general way, and we hope that our caller will actually, our online participant will actually take this back to the treating healthcare team. But if you could just give some ideas about, again, more direction about just managing pain. You've covered that, addressed it in part already, but if you could just say a few more things about this.
So the question is that the patient has been offered narcotic pain medications and it has not been sufficient?
Yes, that's true. Relistor for opioid-induced constipation.
For constipation. So the question is for so if it's for pain control versus pain medication-related constipation. If Relistor, you know, has not helped, what we typically do is if it's a really severe constipation question, we do go ahead and get our pain team involved to try to answer if there is anything in the diet that could be changed. If a different opioid can be tried. Sometimes it could also be a matter of paresis, where there is some dysfunction in the bowel, not just slow transit related to narcotics, but from the cancer process. So all that needs to be reviewed. Clearly, you know, it is a challenge, but it does work in about 50 to 60% of our patients. Some of the newer opioid related constipation treating medications, but we work closely with our pain team to see if there are any other opportunities.
So actually involving the pain team would be a really good idea for our for this participant or others who are having these challenges. Okay, excellent. And then with another question from one of our online participants, what is the effectiveness of GTX therapy for stage 3 borderline resectable? Actually, let me start that again, and Dr. O'Reilly, if you could address this question in a general way. What is the effectiveness of GTX therapy for a stage 3 borderline resectable 3mm tumor in the uncinate process, which has portal involvement? Thank you. Again, if you could address this in a general way.
Certainly, yes. So the question is, one, what is GTX and where does it fit in the treatment of pancreas cancer? So oncology is full of acronyms, and GTX is one of them. It stands for gemcitabine. The T is the trade name for docetaxel, Taxotere, and the X is capecitabine, otherwise known as Xeloda. And this is a combination of drugs that we use with, I would say, some frequency in certain parts of the U.S. For pancreas cancer. It is an active combination. It isn't as supported by as high a level of evidence as, for example, FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, meaning it hasn't gone through that rigor of a phase 3 trial. Nonetheless, activity has been demonstrated and reproducibly so. In the context of the question, the treatment is being administered with the intent of trying to downstage the cancer, meaning trying to see if some shrinkage can be obtained, and even more so if some retraction of the tumor away from blood vessels can be achieved. And that can make the difference between being able to undergo an optimal surgery, which is where an operation is done, and a clear margin, meaning no residual cells where the surgical team cut. And that's always something that we're trying to optimize in this cancer. So it's an active approach used in this setting and used in metastatic pancreas cancer.
Another question from one of our online participants. What about pancreatic enzyme therapy? So, Ms. Petzl, do you want to say a little bit more about that for this particular, and again, in a general way, so that everyone can benefit from hearing about this?
Sure. Well, pancreatic enzymes can definitely be helpful in managing symptoms and helping patients to be able to maintain their weight, get adequate absorption of nutrients. There is no scientific evidence to support the use of pancreatic enzymes as a therapy, an anti-cancer therapy, but certainly as a help for the body to help support the patient as they go through treatment.
And then there's another question about folic acid. Let me just find this. Let me see. From Karen, I have just started GTX chemo and have gotten conflicting information about folic acid. What foods can I eat? What foods do I need to avoid? So, Dr. Rai, could you just start with that, and then Ms. Petzl, if you could continue on with that, but just the concept of folic acid and how that impacts, does it impact treatment?
Yes, so the question is, should one be taking vitamins along with certain chemotherapies? And
yes.
Folic acid, a supplement commonly available, and in general, we don't recommend outside dietary sources taking extra amounts of vitamins with chemotherapy, partly because they have some antioxidant properties, and the way some of our chemotherapeutic drugs work requires an oxidation process. So at least theoretically, there can be data that suggests it isn't such a good thing to do. But I think when it's within the diet and it's not excessive, that generally doesn't pose a problem. And I'll pass this over to Maria to add here.
And I would just concur with what Dr. O'Reilly said. When it's from a whole food source, when it's in the food, our bodies tend to know what to do with it. When it's taken out and put in a supplement form, it potentially could have some interferences with treatment. So really taking that question specifically about GTX, taking that question back to your primary team to discuss a little bit more. But there really aren't any foods to avoid with regards to folic acid or folate.
Thank you. Very helpful. And another question from one of our online participants. So should I have my, this is for Dr. Bharattachary, and should I have my pancreatic cancer tumor sequenced? Could you address this in a general way? And if you can explain what.
So when we talk about sequencing, it is, there are many levels to it. And the more common terminology is next-generation sequencing. It can be a panel from anywhere looking at 50 genes to about 300 genes. And it is helpful sometimes. I would say that in about 70% of our patients, we see some mutations called KRAS, P53, and SMAD4. These are the three common mutations for which today we do not have great drugs, but there could be clinical trials that might be beneficial. For the other 20 to 30% of patients, there might be additional mutations for which there may be clinical trials available. So I think the most important thing is to have a conversation with your doctor to see whether it is in your benefit to proceed with sequencing in terms of, is there tissue available? What exactly is the plan with the current landscape of therapies available to the patient and the stage of the cancer?
Thank you. Very excellent. And a question for Dr. O'Reilly, which I know you've covered, but the question of the role of immunotherapy from one of our online participants and the use of Optiva for pancreatic cancer. If you could just comment on that.
Sure. So immune therapies, just to think about this a little differently. So the idea here is that immune therapies optimize our immune system so that we're not tackling the cancer cell directly, but leveraging the body's own immune system to tackle the cancer cell. So that the approach is different to typical treatments like chemotherapy. And we mentioned a little earlier that we've seen a number of successes in a variety of different malignancies, and that, of course, has spurred the development of immune therapies in other malignancies, including pancreas cancer. And certainly there are some signals that pancreas cancer can be what we call an immunogenic tumor, meaning it has the potential to have the immune system leveraged to try and tackle the disease. But we know that the milieu of immune cells perhaps isn't the optimal one compared to what we see in other diseases. And some of the strategies that are being used in pancreas cancer are combining several different types of immune therapies together. We mentioned a little earlier checkpoint inhibitors. These are a class of drugs that are licensed for melanoma and lung cancer, so combinations of those are being evaluated. Combining a checkpoint inhibitor and a vaccine is another way that we might see benefit. Combining a checkpoint inhibitor and chemotherapy, or using radiation as a primer of the immune system. So there are many, many trials in development in pancreas cancer, which is exciting. But we still have a lot to learn about what's the best way to enhance the immune system. And we certainly know that these treatments are not FDA approved at this time, but there are some that are in phase two and phase three, the later phases of clinical trial development. And indeed, we'll have some data from a post-operative prevention strategy. We'll have some data emerging later this year, which will also, I think, be very interesting with regard to an immune therapy approach in pancreas cancer. So I think the key message is it's early days in this whole era. We've a lot to learn, but there's a lot of excitement around this topic and where it fits in this disease.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. And we have one late-breaking question here, which I know is a question that comes up on a lot of our calls, but one of our online participants, what about sugar and cancer? I've always read that cancer loves sugar and therefore should be avoided, but the only foods that I'm currently able to tolerate are sweet, chocolate especially. Thank you. So I'm going to ask all of our speakers to address it in different ways. I'm going to ask Dr. Bhattacharya to go first, Dr. O'Reilly second, Ms. Petzl third, and Ms. Ezra, if you could just comment on just the complexity that people have and just in that you hear in the group about just the experience of what to do when they have cancer, so pancreatic cancer. So Dr. Bhattacharya, if you could address this first.
So yes, patients do ask us what about sugar and you know, high carb foods, and if that's the only thing they can tolerate or enjoy. You know, the first thing I do ask my patients is what is their caloric intake for the day and their protein intake. So in terms of sugar feeding the cancer, I don't think we have you know, enough data to say that we need to radically change our diets to make it sugar free or not even have it in moderation. So I would say the science isn't there yet to do that. In terms of you know, eating a high sugar diet and maintaining the calories and the protein, that's different. And I think spending time with a nutritionist as well as with the doctors to figure out how to make it more balanced is usually a very helpful maneuver.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. O'Reilly?
Yeah, so following on that, and completely agree that there's not a simple relationship between what we eat in our diet and what happens in terms of our malignancy. It certainly is possible that over long periods of time, dietary patterns influence the risk of the disease, and we mentioned the association of Western lifestyle and pancreas cancer, so I think we're all obligated to do our best in terms of a healthy diet and moderation in every constituent. I think there's one other complexity here for people with pancreas cancer, and that's the fact that diabetes is a common association and sometimes a prodrome, if not a follow-on, to this disease, and glucose and sugar management there can be important, and endorse the idea of working with a nutritionist or dietitian, along with often the expertise of an endocrinologist in terms of managing diabetes and pancreas cancer.
Thank you so much. And Ms. Petzl?
Well, certainly this is a very common question, and as Dr. Bhattacharya and Dr. O'Reilly have said, this is a very complex question. And I know I'm referring to other resources here, but there's a great resource to help dive into this a little bit more at oncologynutrition.org. And if you put in sugar and cancer, there's a wonderful explanation that will hopefully help people feel much more comfortable with their eating choices. The bottom line is that there is no evidence that sugar makes that sugar makes cancer grow in humans. Every cell in our body utilizes glucose, which is the basic form of carbohydrate, and that's the primary fuel for every cell in our body. So you cannot simply eliminate carbohydrate intake or eliminate sugar from the diet or from the body. You would truly be harming healthy cells in your body. So this goes a little bit more to that not feeling guilty about choices. So with all the information that's out there on the internet, it can be a scary world to navigate. So leaning to your healthcare team and to a registered dietitian to help you navigate this a little bit more closely is where I would recommend you go.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That's really helpful. Thank you very much. And Ms. Ezra, if you could just comment really about the discussions that happen in the groups around just, you know, what to do and the sharing that happens there. If you could comment on that just to kind of wrap this up.
Well, my pancreatic telephone group we've been having sessions for a very, very long time. Generally, the discussion is about how to remain optimistic when you're on chemo for a very long time and you're not sure what the next chemo drug will be if you feel like you've gone through all of the standard choices. I think we tried to laugh as much as possible and to encourage each other. And in terms of the beginning discussion about sugar, you know, I always tell my clients to eat everything in moderation, that there's no way of us knowing what's really right for the body and what's wrong for the body. Just to, as you said, you know, don't beat up on yourself because you decided to have an ice cream after dinner. Everything in moderation. But, you know, the groups really are powerful because you don't feel alone. Somebody else is understands exactly what you mean about your energy level, how you feel trapped in the house because you need to be close to a bathroom, you know, and how that becomes a security for you and you don't want to necessarily go someplace, but then how you feel that you're not really living your life the way you want to because you've isolated yourself in one place. So there are really some very deep places. Some of them are dark, but we try to approach them with respect and dignity and humor. And I think that this group has been very successful in doing that. And if you're interested, just give the Hope Line a call. We would be happy to add you to our members.
Thank you so much, Liz. And I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been really an extraordinary call. Really excellent speakers, outstanding speakers, excellent questions, really wonderful questions that I know you all struggle with. And also, there were more questions that we haven't gotten to. So I did promise all of you that I would let you know how to get your questions answered. So there are a couple of choices here. This call being on pancreatic cancer, I would say that one thing we always recommend is that you all call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237 with any medically focused questions. Again, that number is 1-800-422-6237. However, also, we do have the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network that has a really wonderful, lots of information. And so I would also encourage you to call them at 1-877-272-6226. Again, 1-877-272-6226. And that's in all the materials that we've sent you, our brochure, on our website, so you definitely can actually contact them as well. In addition, though, if you have concerns about getting practical or financial assistance or copay assistance, or if you have concerns about actually talking with one of our oncology social workers for either individual help or counseling or someone to talk to or joining one of our support groups, as Liz said, our telephone support group or online support groups, either as a person living with pancreatic cancer or a caregiver of someone with pancreatic cancer, we have lots of groups and different programs available for you as well. And we also have many of these programs coming up, and we also have publications and, of course, our website, www.cancercare.org. But if you do want to speak with one of our staff here, one of our social workers here, I would call 1-800-813-4673. So as we conclude this program today, in full recognition that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour, we want to be sure that you feel not alone, as Elizabeth has said. We want you to now feel you're connected to this cancer care world here, and that we are simply a telephone call away or visiting our website for some of our international participants or those in the U.S. who really want to pose a question or concern or connect here with us here in that way as well. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. We have lots of programs coming up, so you probably will all get information about the upcoming programs. And I want to thank you all, and I want to wish you a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.